supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to Common Space. I'm your host, Jamie Jay. Common Space is a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY to bring you true personal stories that give new insights into the pressing issues of our time. There's this photograph that I came across on the internet. It's of an Ethiopian boy about 5 years old. He's standing in the low-mowed, grassy part of a yard. The boy is focused on the business of organizing and securing what looks like a bunch of banana leaves he's holding, seemingly not even aware of the photographer. Normal, right? Well, a closer look reveals that it's anything but. You see, I came across this photo after doing a web search for ghosts. The photographer believes that's what she captured in this photo, because standing next to the boy like a conjoined twin is the image of another boy appearing like a ghostly shadow. This second boy is translucent, with his frame literally filled in and colored by the grass, dirt, and stones of the yard behind him. Unlike the real boy, who's preoccupied by the things of life he's trying to hold on to keep ordered, that ghost of a boy looks straight into the camera, straight at the photographer, at me, as if challenging us all to see him. That unyielding stare of his insists that I not look away. So today on Common Space, we're looking back at the ghost of the child within each of us, the child we hide, silenced, the child we lost, and the resilience required to finally make peace with such ghosts. And this note, some of the subject matter of this program is best suited for mature audiences. For Amrita Subramanian, there was a small child within that had been silenced for decades out of self-perceived necessity, until the night of a first-person art story slam, when the theme was small but mighty. Amrita finally let that child speak.
So, I'm born in a country called India. Some of you might be familiar with it. They have a singular tradition that takes you from Homo erectus to drooling primate. It is called touching the feet. And you touch a feet to show respect. You touch a feet of an elder to gain blessings. Now, most of the time I imagine my friends are imaginary. Gives me courage. In fact, in this moment, I'm thinking all of you are imaginary. And I'm standing here alone, talking to myself, which is very normal, because I have every instinct in my body which is saying, chicken out of the story. So, you're going to travel with me, because I dare not do it alone. You're going to travel with me 33 years ago, when, on a very dark night, it was the darkest night of my life, and it was the Festival of Lights, Diwali. When we celebrate Festival of Lights, you go trick-or-treating. Yes? So, come with me. My mom and me, four-year-old. So this is my mom. Hello, good evening, happy Diwali. Happy Diwali. Amrita, you are going to go house to house and give sweets to everyone. You have to touch their feet. No. No, Amrita, you can't say no. It's all uncles and aunties. Uncles? Are they family? No, beta, in India, every Tom, Dick and Harry is your uncle. We are very populated. We are all related. No. Amrita, you are small. You can't say no all the time, okay? Oh, look. There is Uncle Harry and Uncle Dick. Go touch feet. No. Bita, Amrita, they love you. Every time they come home, they play with you all the time. That's why, Ma, they hurt me when you're not looking. When you're in the kitchen. What? What are you saying? Before all the people, you are going to bring shame to the family? Go touch feet. No. 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 Ma! Go touch feet. You're small. Stay small. And I run. And I run. And I run. Far away. And I run. I'm hoping somewhere there's some place to hide. And I find this hole in a garden. And I sit there quietly. Just hoping that nobody finds me. Just hoping that I just die here. Because I'm so small. And I stayed there for a very, very long time. It was a very dark night. And then I see a tick in the soil, climbing over everything. And I think I'm stronger than that. And very slowly, I start coming out of my hole. And I step out. You have to wonder why I'm telling this story. Because it's so easy to go back to that hole. Like this, I'm in the hole. But how many nights will I die for that one night that I didn't die? I am choosing to step out of that darkness. And I'm choosing my life. In psychology, that's called positive illusion. A child lies to protect from complete shutdown because of fear and debilitating pain. In your silent acceptance of the absolutely flawed life I have and my story, I release that. My heart is throbbing insanely, and it says thank you.
Amrita Subramanian is a business consultant and executive coach. She says she's grateful to have found a safe place to share her stories to kind audiences. And that means you. You know, I think we all hold certain things within, you know, for what we think are good reasons, that can become a darkness there. According to DoSomething.org, 1 out of 3 girls and 1 out of 5 boys will be sexually abused before they reach 18. 90% of child sexual abuse victims know their perpetrator in some way, and 68% are abused by a family member. But storytelling, true personal storytelling, has the power to draw out the darkness when we break the silence. Like Amrita, letting the truth come out can be a release and a first step toward resilience. Our next storyteller is Timmy Mack. Now, the person Timmy needed to speak to was often right in front of him, but he couldn't find the words to confront him. Then, something changed everything.
I have an old school Irish father. And what that means is he takes all of his emotions and he buries them as deep down as he possibly can. Anytime I call, he always answers the phone the same way. Your mother's not here. And he does that now that we have a good relationship. But we didn't always. There was a day that I'll never forget where our relationship took a turn because it had to hit bottom before it could build up. I just finished a glass of milk, and my mom was really angry because she didn't have any for her coffee, and she's screaming at me over it. And I wanted to explain to her that we didn't live in the countryside. And by the time her coffee was done brewing, I would be at the store and back with an entire cow for her. But logic tended to escape her when she would get upset like that. And so I decided I would just go grab my wallet and get to the store as quick as I could. And when I got to the top of the steps, my dad stopped, and he looked up at his paper, and he spoke to me for the first time in what felt like years. And he said, "I can't wait until you get the fuck out of here." And so clearly I had outworn my welcome. And I told him, "You know what? I'm going to leave. And then you and I, we don't have to pretend to have a relationship anymore." And I made my way downstairs and I started to pack myself because I just wanted to get out of there. And that's when I heard these footsteps. And they were slow and they were heavy. And they had a purpose. And when my dad hit the bottom step, our eyes locked and he made a beeline right towards me. Now, if I had been a kid, that beeline would have came with fist cocked because he would have beat the shit out of me. But I'm an adult now, and he can't put his hands on me. But he stopped right here. And I knew he was mad because his face was red, and there was spit curling up in the corners of his mouth. And he said, "I don't need to pretend to have a relationship with you because you're a f***ing loser. You hear me?" And I mean, he was right here. I heard him. I knew exactly what he had said. But he decided he needed to repeat it. And as he did, he took his huge sausage fingers and he drove them into my chest like he was trying to bury the words into me. "You're a f***ing loser." And they said, "You quit at everything you do because you have no f***ing heart. You hear me?" And kind of like, "Dad, yes, you're right next to me." But I knew he was going to repeat it again. But this time he beat his own chest to emphasize the words. "No f***ing heart." And then he turned and he left. And I finished packing. And I got to the front door, and I turned around, and I looked at my dad sitting there reading the paper. And I wanted to tell him how it was his fault. It was his fault that I didn't know how to fight back. It was his fault I didn't have any heart. Because when you're a little kid, and you're getting the shit kicked out of you by someone who's 6'6", 260 pounds, you don't learn how to fight back. You learn how to duck and cover and wait for the shit to stop. And that's how I live my life. I'm waiting for the shit to stop. I wanted to tell him all that. But the only words that came out were, "I love you, Dad." And he never looked up from his paper. My wife and I were expecting our first child November 1st. And we're having a baby boy. And I think a lot, thank you. I think a lot about the first time I get to hear him say, "I love you, Dad." And if being an old school father means you have to hide your emotions, I'm really glad that I'm new school because I can't wait to say it back.
I've had the pleasure of meeting Timmy Mac's beautiful wife. And when baby Mac gets here, I know they're going to be great parents. And they'll have a new story to share. Now, I've also had the pleasure of knowing our next storyteller, Lisa Nelson Haynes. Lisa shares her story of experiencing injustice and discrimination as a sixth grader, and she and her mother decided not to take it sitting down.
It's 1977. I know for some of y'all, that's a long time back, but anyway, 1977, all right? I have just transferred from Evans Elementary, which was very diverse, to St. Louis Catholic School in Yadin, Delaware County. I was now one of four black students in the entire school, from kindergarten to the eighth grade. I'm in Sister Stephen's class of sixth grade, all right? One day I get off the school bus, go to the intersection across, and the safety crossing guard says, "Hey, Kizzy, you can cross the street now." And I was like, he couldn't be talking to me. Kizzy? And I looked around, he was staring right at me, and I was the only black person standing at the corner, and all these white kids, and they all just walk across the street like, "What's the problem?" And I'm like, "Kizzy?" Now, for those of you that don't know, Kizzy was the daughter of Kunta Kinte. She was a slave on the miniseries Roots. So this cat was calling me out my name, all right? And I looked at him, and I was like, my name is Lisa, not Kizzy. He's like, whatever, Kizzy, cross the street. All right. I crossed the street. Later on that afternoon when I got home, I told my mom all about it. I was like, do you believe this cat was calling me Kizzy today, calling me a slave? She was like, what? She told my dad when he got home. And they decided that they were going to write a note to Sister Stevens and clear this up, ask her to stop this guy from calling me Kizzy. Next day, get off the school bus, go to the intersection, same thing. Kizzy, come on, Kizzy. Kizzy, you, come on, cross the street. And I was like, boy, I'm going to knock you out. Right? So I walk across the street, but I kind of look at him like, I got something for you in my bag. You just wait. Sister Stephen going to get with you. I get to the classroom, hand Sister Stephen my note, right? Go to my desk, start unpacking. A couple of minutes later, Sister Stephen comes over and she says, Nelson, what's the problem here? I was like, it's just like my mom said. That boy's calling me Kizzy. Kizzy's a slave. She was like, I know who Kizzy is. Kizzy is on Roots, played by that lovely colored actress, Leslie Uggams. She's my favorite colored actress. I don't know what the problem is. I love me some Leslie Uggams. And I sat there like, oh, Lord. This was not going the way that I planned, right? All right. Get home. My mom said, how'd it go? I said, Mom, she told me that Leslie Uggams was her favorite colored actress. My mom was like, what? She said, did she speak to that boy? I said, no, no. So my mom wrote another note, and she said, you know what? I'm going in there, and I'm going to talk to her directly, her and the principal. Couple of days later, my mother marches in there with me, beginning of school, waits for the principal and Sister Stevens to come down, right? A few pleasantries go by. Next thing you know, the principal says, Mrs. Nelson, what's the problem? How can I help you? My mom said, listen, I did not send my daughter here to be verbally abused and be called Kizzy, a slave from Roots. The principal said, oh, you're right. I'm so sorry. We'll take care of this right away. Lisa, next time you have a problem, please come see me right away. Sister Stevens, on the other hand, she wasn't ready to let this go. You know, Mrs. Nelson, I don't see what the problem is. Kizzy is my favorite colored actress. I remember the first time I saw her on the Ed Sullivan Show. In fact, she kind of reminds me of Lisa. Lisa's my favorite colored student. My mom was like, whoa, wait a minute now. First of all, Lisa is your only colored student here at St. Louis. And we ain't colored no more. We black. We're black now. Let's go with black. And if you don't take care of this right away, I mean right now, okay, I will sue you. We will have our own little march on Washington around St. Louis. Okay? And it will not be pleasant. So, Sister Stevens, she understood that. I wasn't called Kizzy no more. I was called some other things during my time in St. Louis, but not Kizzy. Thank you.
Lisa Nelson Haynes is the executive director of Philadelphia Young Playwrights. You know, I don't normally talk about my own childhood ghosts, but the little girl in me is remembering her uncle out on the front porch fighting the demons of his youth. He's long gone now, and he'll never be back. But what happens when they're gone and you still have something to say, like, I wish things had been better for you? But the space between us is forever. I wrote these words to fill that space. He let loose story shards the nights I stumble upon him alone on the porch, glassy-eyed, tattered old high school yearbook open in his lap, thinning newspaper articles about a running, jumping boy wonder dangling loosely. He passes his fingers over them like they are love. a father in the lamplight. Not mine, but the only one that stayed. It always starts, he in the night, out there alone, him rocking back and forth to a sound I strain for, but that escapes me. He spots me watching from the door jamb. I shrink back, but his eyes call softly, softly, saying, please, lulling me to kneel at his feet. Two of us together thumb through the pages, fingering the lifelines. In this photo, he's the lone colored boy, boring his heels in the ground at the chalk line, surrounded on either side by white runners, yet staring on cocksure. On the next page, arms outstretched, he's straddling the air and scaling hurdles. Here, he's way ahead of the rest, almost out of their sight. Under the newspaper headline, Record Breaker, is a photo of his thrust chest breaking the tape first. I believe I see a church off in the distance in that one. His sway sound, I can hear it too now. It's church bells ringing, ringing, ringing for him, calling to everyone saying his name. The bells crescendo and he's hearing them and I'm hearing them and we're dancing, just the two of us. Then the bells, the ringing, clanging, majestic bells, slow. In another photo, a runner alone takes a sip from the colored only fountain, while his white teammates sip cool water from a shiny trophy passed among them. By the turn of the last page, the bells have gone cold. He's back on the porch, unrung, me staring up at him. Storm clouds come to his voice. I was the fastest one of all. He squeezes my tiny wrist. I hum with pain. He flings my hand off the page, snaps the book closed, buries it in his chest and says, mine. When his over face crumbles, I see the demon and run into the closed eyes of the house. But I know it's hopeless. After all, he is the record breaker. Each time his eyes said please, I came to him out there on the porch. Would have knelt at his feet 1,000 times more just to be with him in his brightness, if only for a moment. I've lived long enough to have silence come to me out there on the porch, heavy with the past. Yearned for the sound that shatters it. Know the sober vacancy that remains after the flickering, dimming bells have gone. How penetrable humanity when promise is a thief in the night. You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. And it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Please subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and Stitcher. I'm your host, Jamie J. Our next storyteller is Jay Butera. Jay had what he calls a primal dream from childhood. But his primal dream also contained a primal fear. In order to get past his fear, he would have to come face to face with the beast of those dreams. Here's Jay.
All of my life, I have wanted to sleep alone in the woods at night. This has been a dream of mine. And there's one little thing coming between me and this dream all of my life. I am scared of bears. I mean, I'm really scared of bears. All of my nightmares have always involved bears in the woods. When I was a kid, in the closet, I had to sleep with a light on in the closet because I knew there were bears in there, just waiting for darkness to get me. But I didn't want to give up on this dream, this primal dream of sleeping in the forest at night. So I read a quote a few years ago, and it said, "The only way out is through." And that told me the only way to deal with this fear of bears that was keeping me from this dream would be to face a bear. Head on, stare him down. Now, there's a trail in northern New Jersey that is infamous among hikers for bear sightings. It's one to avoid. But I decided I'm going to go to that trail, and I am going to hike until I find a bear. I'm not proud of this decision because, in retrospect, it seems really foolish. But it tells you something about the state of my mind. I wanted to get past this so I could move on with my life. I went to the trail, parked my car at the trailhead, and started to hike. Somewhere into this hike, I come across some hikers that were coming from the other direction, and they said to me, there's bear cubs ahead. There's bear cubs ahead. And I knew what they were saying. They were saying, turn around now, run, you know, save yourself. But I said, this is great. Bear cubs, you know, they're little guys. And they're cute, and it would be a great way to get to know bears, you know, without the fear of this thing. And so I walk on, and I walk, and I'm not seeing the bear cubs. And it starts to get kind of late in the afternoon. I'm worried about getting back to my car before nightfall because, you know, I'm not going to sleep in the woods at this point. And I turn around, and I'm still on hot DEFCON 5 for these bears. And when you're afraid of bears, everything looks like bears. Tree stumps, boulders, rocks. Everything looks like a bear. And I came around a bend, and there were the real things. There were three little bear cubs. Man, they were cute. They were beautiful. And I'm thinking, I can do this. I can meet these bears. I can stare them down. But I forgot one thing. Where you have bear cubs, you're probably going to have a mother bear. And if there's one thing I knew about bears, it's that you don't want to meet a mother bear with bear cubs. I've read all the books about it. And you know that they're the ones that are on edge and really protective, and they're the ones that are going to get you. So, I don't know what I'm going to do, because there's the mother bear cub ahead. Now, there's my car somewhere down there. It's getting dark back there, and there's a mother bear cub who's looking pretty angry. I don't know what I'm going to do. I freeze. And at that moment, behind me comes another hiker, which seemed wild, because there had been no one behind me on the trail the whole day, and this guy appears out of nowhere. I later learned he was a yoga master from India. And I say, "Stop, bears, bears." And he says, "It's okay. If we walk with peace in our hearts, she won't hurt us." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Do you understand what I'm telling you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Can you walk with peace in your heart?" I said, "Yes." And I don't know why I said yes, but I did. And I started to breathe. I tried to breathe peace and calmness into my heart, into this pounding heart. And we walked on. We walked toward the bears. And when we got right aside, as close as we would be on that trail to the mother bear, we both stopped for some reason. And I looked over, and she was looking at me in the eyes. That's the other thing I remember from the books about bears. You don't want ones looking you in the eye. That's a real aggressive sign. And I said, "Okay, peace in my heart." And I breathed, and I tried to smile and think, what would this yogi behind me do? And here we are. And the bear put her head down toward the ground. And I'm trying to remember from the books, what does that mean in bear language? But I hear this snuffling. I could hear her breathing. I hear the snuffling in the ground. She started to forage again. She went back to eating. She was standing down, and she had sensed that we meant no harm. And so we walked on. And with this peace in our heart, we walked forward. And we got past, way past the bears, and I turned around. I grabbed this yogi, this mysterious bear whisperer from India, and I said, "How do you know bears like this? How did you know what to do?" And he said, "I've never seen a bear in my life." That was amazing. And I had trusted my life to this man's intuition. But I'm glad I did. It saved us both. And to this day, I think back and wonder why I trusted him. And I just kind of think, you know, you have to believe in things, however little they are. You have to believe in something. You have to have some faith in order to walk on in this world. Thank you very much.
Jay Butera is an entrepreneur, writer, and speaker living near Philadelphia who works as an advocate for nonpartisan clean energy and climate change solutions.
Harvey Weinstein's star is falling fast. Now more than 40 women, including some of the world's most famous stars, are accusing the disgraced Hollywood mogul of sexual misconduct or worse.
Bill Cosby, actor and comedian, has been accused of rape and sexual assault, including drugging them with alcohol combined with pills, by multiple women.
Several women speaking out, accusing Donald Trump of touching them inappropriately.
Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, even our president, and so many others, accused or guilty, we will never know about. Workplace harassment has been all over the headlines, with no end in sight. Storyteller Kathleen Lafferty had a career she loved for 10 years. Then it ended, badly for her. But what happens when your kid wants the career you had that was taken from you? Kathleen Lafferty finds a way to move forward through the hopes and dreams of her child.
Hi, it's me, Kathleen. I have a 5-year-old kid, and he's awesome. And he wants to be a firefighter when he grows up. And I'm not talking about the fleeting kindergarten career day type of want to be a firefighter thing. This isn't just Halloween. It's not just dress up day. It's not just Purim. It's every day. This kid has a full set of turnout gear on the ready at all times in our house. And he's pretty serious about it. And I don't know if it's going to go away. I feel it's probably my fault a little bit. I was a firefighter for 10 years. By the time he was, thank you. By the time my son was born, I was out of the job for about a decade. And I don't know that it would have even ever come up if it weren't for the fact that he was so very attracted to the shiny, big red trucks. So I started talking to him about it, and I started telling him what the trucks were for and all the different things that they did. And I was surprised how much I remembered. Be sure you always run with the irons, pair the Halligan bar with the flathead axe. And last fall, we went to 2 or 3 million fire prevention open houses, him and every bit of that full turnout gear. He has 2 different kinds. I got back, small smells, familiar smells, diesel engines, hydraulic tools, sooty fire gear. I hadn't smelled those things in a long time. It kind of brought me back mentally. It was a little hard. I have post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's not from being a 17-year-old. I started when I was 16. It's not from being a 17-year-old kid loading people into helicopters, climbing into crumbled-up cars, or watching an entire family be pulled out of their house and trying to save people of all different shapes and sizes. That's part of the job. That's what I signed up for. I felt like I could do something. Being a firefighter to me meant being empowered. It meant having the gear and the tools and the team to get a job done and to be able to make a difference. And my son has a big heart. I think he gets that, some part of him. He's a smart kid. So, I have PTSD because I was the girl in the locker room. When those trucks came back in the station and we put the gear away, my workspace wasn't the same for me as it was for my male peers. My one boss, he openly said women have no place in the fire service. And my other boss, when I was still a junior trainee, shut the door behind me, and he proceeded to, I thought it was a mentoring session, he proceeded to show me his penis. And I actually held in there strong. I was determined. I was doing a job I believed in, and I really loved it, especially when duty called. But one day, the day my spirit finally broke, even though I hung in for a few years after this, was when I walked in, and I found out that my bunk had been tampered with obscenely. I talked to my boss. He said, "We don't assign bunks anyway. Sleep somewhere else." And how do you know what that is supposed to be anyway? It's like, well, boss, all the guys have been joking around about spunk in the bunk for the last half hour for one thing. But aside from that, I've been here for 7 years, and I've heard it all and I've seen it all. My wish is for my son to pursue his dream. If he wants to be a firefighter, I want him to be a firefighter. I want him to know the bravery and the skill and the teamwork, the determination, even the fears that come with being the person who rides that shiny red truck while it's humming and you're donning gear and it's screaming and you're putting on a pack and you know that you can go in. And that day, when you go into work, you might save a life. I want him to be able to do that. And I want him to be able to come home at the end of every day. Of course, as a mother, my number one thing is for him to come home healthy, in one piece, safe, physically and mentally and morally. I was on the job for 10 years. When the guys talk about grabbing someone's pussy, it's never just talk. They do it. The guys who don't do it, they learn to keep their mouths shut, because it's still considered a rite of passage and a mark of manhood to objectify and sexually assault women. We still reward predators. If you don't believe that, I don't know what much more proof you need than to be in our country right now. But I believe things can change. And when my boy, one day, if that day comes and he continues to want to do this job, I want to be able to see him do it and be able to do it without subscribing to a toxic culture that challenges the good person I know he is on the inside. No guy should ever have to choke down the baggage that comes with working in a toxic, sexist culture. But hey, I still believe in miracles, and I think we can make a difference. And my son, he isn't the first generation that's going to do it. I think we're all going to do it, and I think there are going to be a lot of important conversations. Thanks a lot for listening. Love, Kathleen.
Kathleen Lafferty is a writer, storyteller, and a mom. She's currently working on a memoir about how being an American woman working in a man's job can lead to some pretty dark places. You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Please subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're listening, give us a rating. I'm your host, Jamie J. You know, resilience over pain, past or present, is something I think we have to fight for. But what if the thing you have to be resilient about is an immovable thing? Emmy Mahmoud is the 2015 Individual World Poetry Slam champion. She's also a poet and activist born in Darfur, Sudan. Emmy attended Masterman High School right here in Philadelphia before going on to Yale University. She's been an activist advocating for attention to the continuing violence in Darfur. In 2016, she was invited to a roundtable with President Obama when he visited the Islamic Society of Baltimore. Emmy shared her stories and poetry with us at a Common Space Live event.
Memories of my childhood live between the rings of sand around my ankles and the desert heat in my lungs. I still believe that nothing washes worry from tired skin better than the Nile and my grandma's hands. Every day, I go to school with the weight of dead neighbors on my shoulders. The first time I saw bomb smoke, it didn't wind and billow like the heat from the kitchen hearth, but it forced itself on the Darfur sky, smothering the sun with tears that it stole from our bodies. The worst thing about genocide isn't the hunger, the murder, the politics, it's the silence. For 3 months, they closed the schools down because people like us are an eyesore. So the first month, we took it. The second, we waited. And the third month, we met underneath the date palm trees, drinking up every second our teachers gave us, turning fruit pits into fractions. On the last day, they came with a message, put them in their place. We didn't stand a chance because flesh was never meant to dance with silver bullets. So we prayed for the sun to come and melt daggers from our backs. I hid underneath the bed that day with four other people. 12 years later, and I can't help but wonder where my cousins hid when the soldiers torched the houses, threw the bodies in the wells, so if the weapons didn't get you, the poison would, and sometimes they didn't want to use bullets because it would cost them more than we did. What does it matter? I've seen 16 ways to stop a heart when you build nations on someone's bones. What sense does it make to break them? And one day, my mother choked on rifle smoke. My father washed the blood from his face. My uncles carried half the body to the hospital and the rest to the grave, and we watched. For every funeral we planned, there were 60 we couldn't. Half the sand in the Sahara tastes a lot like powdered bone. And when the soldiers came, our blood on their ankles, I remember their laces, scarlet footprints on the floor. Our parents came home with broken collarbones and a taste of fear carved into their skin, and it was impossible to believe in anything. Fear is the coldest thing in the desert, and it burns you. Bows you down to half your height and owns you, and no one hears you. Because what could grow in the desert anyway?
The war in Darfur began in 2003 when rebel groups began fighting the government of Sudan, which they accused of oppressing Darfur's non-Arab population. The government responded to attacks by carrying out a campaign of ethnic cleansing against Darfur's non-Arabs. This resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of civilians and the indictment of Sudan's president for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court.
I saw a boy make his final stand today, face down in a bed of sand. Body prone, bent, broken like the waves. His chest was not moving. His heart did not beat. Everything around him was suspended in the varied turmoil of land and water, push and pull, as if each were trying to reclaim him. It is like that sometimes when I see the corpse of a stranger. That kind of death from the outside of someone else's final breath. It makes the air stop, the ocean turn more slowly, the land a cradle, a cemetery, a monument, a stone, like a dead boy resting in the sand.
The UN estimates as many as 300,000 people have been killed in the Darfur genocide. But the Sudanese government says that the death toll has been grossly inflated. Nevertheless, every day the Sudanese fear for the well-being of their loved ones. Here's Emmy's story about another boy, her little brother.
Muhammad had a gorgeous mind. He captured the speed of light in the palm of his hands and learned how to bend time. At less than a meter tall, he was a human race car, zipping through the entire sections of the Sahara in a matter of moments. Little boys are incredibly aerodynamic. Once they start running, no one can catch them. Muhammad started running before he knew what he was running from. One day, I was taking a nap in the war zone when my mom came, woke me, and said, "Your brother just ran outside looking for you. I tried to find him, but he was too fast." The first thing I thought is this is a problem, because in the first 48 hours after a child disappears, the chances of finding them alive decrease by 50%. And in a war zone, that number drops significantly. Our town was full of mercenaries, merchants, army vehicles, everything you could possibly imagine. So when I got to the final house and I couldn't find my brother, my mind went numb. The first hour passed, and everyone was looking for him. The second hour, and the heat alone was unbearable. By the third hour, the combinations and permutations of everywhere he could possibly be were endless. Imagine trying to psychoanalyze a three-year-old when every possibility is staring you in the face. There are warplanes overhead, curfew is approaching, and everyone has that look in their eyes, like they're imagining every child that died the exact same way, every bomb or bullet or person that took them. There's this four-lane road that separates my township from the next. And each day, aid vehicles, army trucks, all kinds of traffic goes through there. Before I move on, I want to address this feeling that I always get when I talk about this, this feeling that we all have, especially if you're a parent or a sister or if you've ever loved a three-year-old. When I was looking for him, I thought I was feeling his fear. Is he hungry? Tired? Is someone hurting him? My family was lucky because for us, that feeling ended. For a lot of families, it never ends. When I crossed that road and found my brother alive, I'll never forget what he said. "Emmy, I found you. I was looking everywhere for you. I didn't know whether to yell or cry or laugh. I just held him." It's life in the midst of war and conflict. You get these moments of clarity where everything just seems so far away. But every time I think of my brother and what he was willing to do to find me, I think of all the kids we don't find and the ones we find too late.
Before moving to Philadelphia, Emmy's family lived in Fort Wayne, Indiana. In February 2016, three young Sudanese refugees were murdered execution style there. Two of the young men killed were Emmy's cousins. After surviving genocide in Darfur, only to lose their lives to such violence right here in the U.S. was an unimaginable nightmare for Emmy. The deaths of the three men, two of whom were Muslim, sparked outrage among many Muslims and non-Muslims alike. They were infuriated by the lack of mainstream news coverage. A 19-year-old was found guilty of the killings, which were apparently committed in a robbery gone bad.
I walk into the morgue. The mortician presents my country splayed across a table, asks me to identify the body. I do not recognize it. Its emaciated form dimmed by a death I did not prepare for. I did not expect losing my culture to feel like this. This cadaver I dared to call an identity once held the belief that I could hold home on the tip of my tongue, in the breadth of my appetite, in the weight of my memories. I only recognize my country in photographs, in tour books, in sepia, not in living color, not in the state of surrender. My stomach failed me first, gripping down on processed food, the bite of bile on my disobedient tongue. My ears followed, forgetting the timbre of my grandfather's voice, the swift hush of wind over desert sand. Then my accent as they force-fed me this borrowed language. There's something about the taste of assimilation that makes you want to get back in the boat. I think of home each time the bank asks me if I want to go paperless. Don't they know that people of color have been doing that since before Plymouth Rock? Since Underground Railroad, since my uncle's turning my house into a refugee camp, don't they know red, white, and blue? Like stand your ground, like hate crimes, like shoot to kill. Only stars I see And when the cops roll in to take my neighborhood, my family undocumented, only stripes I see chain us to this prison of an existence. I find myself talking to people across borders more each day. I find myself crying for their countries too. This massacre, this wilted flower field of gutted nations, less melting pot, more guillotine, more disemboweled American dream. If you hate it so much, then why are you here? Because sometimes the buildings collapse, but the rubble keeps bleeding. Because sometimes your blood is the only thing you can carry with you. Because sometimes the water is more inviting than where you stand. And that's how you end up with little kids washed up on foreign soil. And I'm not just talking about the ones that make it. Do you know what it's like to escape genocide only to be gunned down in your own home? Don't they know that they're just finishing the work that our dictator started? Ever since they handed me the death certificate. No, the certificate of naturalization, I've been seeing ghosts. Mostly in the mirror, at the dinner table, at the family picnic. You're naive enough to believe that we could hold home in here without anyone having to leave. I met the president, sat with him at a table too small to hold all the things that brought us there. His hands resting. Where are your chains? They told me your hands were tied. When they sent those kids back, when they wouldn't take the refugees, when they closed down the borders but not Guantanamo, Mr. President, why do they call it the land of the free when even the dead can't leave? Mr. President, what does one caged bird say to another? I couldn't hear him over the sound of the corpse lying between us. He looked at me as if he thought I were afraid. Doesn't he know that back home the women take care of the bodies? Thank you.
So if we fight not to win, but because there's something worth fighting for, what's the reward of resilience? Maya Angelou was an American poet, memoirist, and civil rights activist. She published 7 autobiographies, 3 books of essays, several books of poetry, and was credited with a list of plays, movies, and television shows spanning over 50 years. She had her own thoughts about resilience.
Everyone in the world has gone to bed one night or another with fear or pain or loss or disappointment. And yet each of us has awakened, arisen, somehow made our ablution, seen other human beings, and said, "Morning, how are you? Fine, thanks, and you?" It's amazing. Wherever that abides in the human being, there is the nobleness of the human spirit. Despite it all, black and white, Asian, Spanish, Native American, pretty, plain, thin, fat, vowed or celibate, we rise.
Here is Maya Angelou reading her iconic poem, "Still I Rise."
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high. Still I rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. As if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh, does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there I go rising.
I'm Jamie J. You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. And it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Common Space includes a monthly broadcast and podcast available on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe. And while you're listening, give us a rating. I'm Jamie Brunson, host, producer, and co-writer of Common Space. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of Common Space and co-writer. Special thanks to Naomi Starobin, who executive produced this episode. Our Common Space team members are producer Mike Villers, Dan Gashevsky of First Person Arts, and associate producers Jen Cleary and Ali L'Esperance. Our archivist is Dr. Neil Barden. Our studio engineer is Charlie Kyer. And our theme music is by Subglow. I'm Jamie J. Thank you for listening.